The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in. Back in 2001, I did my only interview with Nicholas Del Banco. At the time, he was still at the University of Michigan, where he worked for many years teaching writing. He's still living. He's 77 years old. He's written 30 books of fiction and nonfiction. Back in 2001, he had just published a book called What Remains. Del Banco was born in London, England, the son of German-Jewish parents. His father was a businessman, art dealer, and sculptor. He was educated at Harvard, Columbia, and then he taught at Bennington College in Vermont, Skidmore College, Saratoga Springs, and became visiting professor at a number of schools, Trinity College, Williams College, Columbia, and the University of Iowa. He was a director of the MFA program at the University of Michigan. And he has served as a chair of the fiction panel for the National Book Awards, as a judge for, among others, the Penn Faulkner Award in Fiction and the Pulitzer Prize. He received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1980 and twice a National Endowment for the Arts Writing Fellowship. In 1962, while he was a student at Harvard, his teacher was John Updike. And I wished I had known this when I did this interview 19 years ago, but there was no Wikipedia then that I know of, or if there was, I didn't check it. Anyway, according to his Wikipedia entry, in the 1960s, Del Banco had a relationship with the singer Carly Simon, which is alluded to in her song, You're So Vain. Let's listen now to Nicholas Del Banco on the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and joining us on the program today is Nicholas Del Banco. His new novel is called What Remains. Welcome to Yellow Springs.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think before we talk about this book, I'd like to talk about you. You've been writing for a while, haven't you?
Beginning to be a disconcertingly long while, yes. I hasten to add that I published my first book when I felt like and probably looked like a baby, but it was 35 years ago. So that is anybody's idea of a good long while.
And this one is number 19 that's been published?
Yes, it is. Most of them have been novels. I think this is my 13th novel, but I've committed a couple of books of short fiction also and four or five of nonfiction.
What is it that made you do this?
Do this as in start writing?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, these many years later, that I can entirely recover the originating impulse, but I think I was one of those wordy children always, you know, sort of singing myself to sleep or rhyming things in the bathroom and speechifying whenever anybody would let me at family occasions, so that I think words were always a part of my world. I got very lucky. I mean, in retrospect, I realize how fortunate I was, and now that I direct a writing program in which I try to encourage young writers to find publishers and enter the profession, I realize all the more completely how fortunate my own entry into it was. America used to be, and in many ways remains, very partial to its youth, very supportive of its youth. And so I was graduated from college with a book contract, and I was able to wave it at my parents and say, see, I don't have to go to business school or law school, I'm a writer. And indeed, my first novel came out when I was 23, and as I said, America was generous, so I had my picture in a lot of papers and magazines and what have you, and yeah, they even made a movie out of it, and so I got another book contract, and by that time, I had a habit of being a writer, and like most habits, it's harder to break than than make, and therefore I've been at it ever since.
How on earth did you have the fortuitous event of being so lucky, being in the right place clearly at the right time with the right book?
Again, I think it's, I mean, though I recognize how wildly fortunate I was, I think it's not all that aberrant or extraordinary. When I taught at Bennington College, where I taught for almost 20 years, one of my students was a fellow called Bret Easton Ellis, who published his first novel while he was still in my writing class. And it was a little funny because, you know, he'd be showing up bleary-eyed from the Today Show at the 10 o'clock seminar. We'd beat him upside the head if he didn't make it in time. So I do know many writers who declared themselves very early on. But I was, innocently enough placed so that somebody noticed where that somebody somewhere was Harvard College. There's no point in pretending otherwise. And I had the great good fortune of having as a teacher John Updike, who taught me one summer and then ran kicking and screaming from the classroom and made his own life outside the academy. But if you've had Updike as a teacher and you go to Harvard and you give a public reading, it's possible, as indeed turned out to be the case for me, there'll be somebody in the audience who is a book publisher and who'll come up and say, sign here at the end of it, and that is what happened. I'm glossing it over, but it's not that different.
I have a vision of you as a youth reading the New Yorker magazine for some reason.
Not entirely wrong, though, as you know from this novel, when I was genuinely a youth, I wouldn't have been reading The New Yorker because I wasn't living in New York.
Were you reading Punch?
Looking at the cartoons, anyway. But yes, that when my family came to this country, we moved outside of New York or near enough to New York so that, of course, that magazine was on the shelf.
My guest is Nicholas Del Bonco. His new novel is called What Remains, and you've segued perfectly. You've let the feline out of the pouch, so to speak. Are you Benjamin?
I wrote this novel early on in at least three stages. Since then, of course, it's had many more drafts, but in the very first part of my conceiving, indeed, What Remains was a memoir rather than a novel. And I used the first person and wrote about myself. And that's still there in both the prologue and the epilogue. The first and the final pages of the book are written in the first person, really about somebody called Nicholas Del Bonco. And then I thought, well, I'd better get out of the first person and into the third, and wrote another draft of it cannily about a little boy called Nicholas so that nobody would ever guess it might be me. But it did at least describe him as a third person remove, or at a third person remove. And the more deeply involved I got in the project, the more clear it seemed to me that even with what I think of as a good memory and as a kind of close recall of childhood, I couldn't, of course, remember what grown-ups had said to me when I was two or three in London in the wartime, in the Blitz. That's where this novel begins and where much of it transpires. And that I would have to use, in effect, the strategies of fiction to reimagine and reconfigure what I could only hazily remember. So in the third draft, I changed Little Nicholas to Little Benjamin, though coyly keeping the three syllables so I didn't have to change the metric patterns of the words or the sentences that I'd already written. And in a way, that's the pattern that the construction of the book followed. Each time I wrote it, it became more and more distant from the self. A good 50% of the novel, in fact, is told from the point of view, or at least over the shoulder, of characters not Benjamin: his mother, his father, his grandmother, his uncle, etc. his elder brother. And by now, I think the answer to your question is less obviously yes than it would have been if you'd asked me this 2 years ago.
I take it that with the passage of time, you've kept returning to this project and looking at it from different aspects.
You take it correctly, Vic, and it's been a very strange experience for me. This is, as you observed, my 19th book, and indeed I've never before written this close to home or this close to the personal bone. Some of my nonfiction, of course, has been directly autobiographical or reminiscent or has reported on a character, roughly speaking, myself in places. But no, I never set out to write an autobiography or even, as a friend of mine calls it, a memoir. But at this stage in my life, I suddenly realized, and this was precipitated by the death of my beloved Uncle Gustav a few years ago in his mid-90s, when he died, I realized that that world was largely closed to me, that most of its inhabitants had gone, and that if I were going to try and recapture it or re-enter it, it was going to be, effectively speaking, now or never. So, yes, I went into this with eyes roughly wide open, saying, okay, time to write about wartime England and being a member of a particular subset of the inhabitants of London, i.e. German Jewish refugees. There was a special kind of exile community in Hampstead, which is an area in the northwest of London in which I was born and raised, and to which I have returned with some frequency, and in which my uncle died about 3 years back. Still, I think nothing prepared me for quite what an inward voyage it was going to be. I've never been psychoanalyzed and only been hypnotized as a kind of party game. But I think I went into something approximating that condition of auto-hypnosis that people write about or talk about that is deep analysis or deep hypnosis. In the watches of the night, I would sort of wake up hearing my elder brother saying, you know, you greedy blighter to me or silly Billy, in ways that I hadn't heard in easily 50 years. And wartime London became vivid rather than just historically researched. I didn't need to do much research to re-enter it.
So you've been piercing the fog on the Hampstead Heath in a way.
Well said and accurate. I flew down here, as I told you before we began this conversation, from a Detroit Metro, Wayne County Airport, and there was enough fog to keep the airplanes idling and to make it an open question as to whether we were going to take off, much less land. But nothing is like the pea soup fog of my childhood that I remember. And I think, in fact, that's literally as opposed to merely metaphorically the case. Now that they've stopped burning coal so routinely in London, those pea soup fogs are effectively things of the past, much the way the smog in L.A. is no longer as daily a fact of life.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Nicholas Del Banco for his book, What Remains. And I occasionally will ask a writer to read something from the book that they have written. I don't do it that often. A lot of writers are good at reading their own work. Some are not so good. Some of them are so adept at it that they are asked to read the audiobook versions of their books. Well, I think Nicholas Del Banco, if he had the time, would be a great reader because he does some readings from his book during this interview, and I really think that they're the highlights of the interview. We'll continue with it right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my interview from 19 years ago with Nicholas Del Banco, his only appearance on the program. He was out on book tour back in the day when a writer like Nicholas Del Banco, who didn't sell a whole lot of books, he wasn't on the bestseller list, but he was prolific and he was one heck of a literary writer,
would come through Dayton, Ohio for a book signing, and that's what he was doing when he arrived in our studios back in 2001. Let's listen now to more from my interview with Nicholas Del Banco.
Nicholas, this is your family, and I can see why you wanted to tell the story, because clearly your family has had an amazing history.
I won't quarrel with that. I think it's true. It's an interesting and a long-lived family in the sense that my first records are in the 1500s, and I pretty much know who was up to what ever since. I'm not particularly proud of this because there's a mixed blessing in belonging to a family that's been declining for 500 or 600 years, but they were very prominent Jews in Italy in the 15th and 16th century, 17th century. The name Del Banco, as you know, who've just returned from Rome, simply means of the bank. They were the first bankers in Venice in the 1600s. They founded the Banco di Giro and lived there quite grandly until, as so often happened before and since, somebody took umbrage, threw them A, into a ghetto, and B, out of the country. They went north to Vienna first, and then to, in my father's family's case, Hamburg in the northern part of Germany, where they lived and prospered for 300 years or so until Hitler said roughly the same thing, which is get the hell out of town and country. And so my father, who is in his 90s now and alive and well in New York City, lives in the third country, which he called home, Germany, for the first 30 years or so of his life, and then the England to which he fled. My mother's family, much the same. And my parents met again in England and married there, and my older brother and I were born there. Then they moved to America for a different set of reasons. This, as I said, is now the third country that he calls home. That, and the second one that I do, that is no longer an extraordinary situation in America. We are very much still a nation of wanderers. I think it's probably the exception rather than the rule that you live in the town where your grandparents were born. But had it not been for Hitler, there's not much doubt in my mind. I would have been, you know, an upper middle class German bürgerlicher citizen, probably in Hamburg, because that had been the case for 300, 400 years and had no particular reason to change.
Or for that matter, if it weren't for whoever in Venice, you would have been an Italian.
Exactly so. Though I have to say that when I return to Venice, which I do when I can, or to Hamburg, which I do very little, or to London, which I do quite a lot, I'm no longer under the illusion that I belong in any of those places. That is true, I think, in general of the expatriate experience. It's certainly true of the experience of being in enforced exile, which was the case with all those German Jews that Hitler didn't manage to kill. It may be particularly the case for the wandering Jew, as in that history of borders crossed that characterizes my family and the people at large. All of which is a way of saying I feel very much at home here and wouldn't trade it.
My guest is Nicholas Del Banco. His new novel is What Remains. You just mentioned the wandering Jew, and you make reference to that concept in the story.
Right.
I try to avoid reading reviews of books that I'm reading for interviews because I don't want to know what happens. Mm-hmm. In this case, I broke my own rule because I saw a review and I really wanted to read it. I wanted to know what the person thought of your book before I read your book. And I think, I can't remember, I think it was in the Times, I think they described your book as not having a plot, if I remember correctly.
there was a generous review of it both in the Sunday Times and in the Daily Times. Are you talking about the Sunday Times? I think so.
One perhaps. Or the other. Yeah. I don't recall. I might have read both of them.
Right.
But it strikes me that the plot of the book is The Wandering Jew.
Well, that's right. And in that regard, it also carries the traces of its original conception as memoir. The plot, insofar as there is one, is, I was born, I was raised, and I'm here still to tell the tale. It's got sequence in that regard. I mean, there are years that antedate other years, but it's not watch them to see if they get out of Auschwitz alive or if they carry off the plot to assassinate the prime minister or anything like that. It's not heady, active stuff in that sense. The sequence of the story is given away in terms of its consequence in the very prologue, i.e., I survived. I alone am here to tell the tale. And that story, the survivor's tale, if you will, the witness's account, is one that I think in this case is sufficiently suspense-filled or worthy of retelling, so that I did not do any of those things that the novelist traditionally does, which is gussy up the action with, car chases and naked people falling out of closets and all of that.
You've got one naked person in the book.
Right. You have read closely, haven't you?
I love that scene, that description.
Thank you. There's an example, and I believe you're referring to the childhood of the mother figure in the novel, Julia, who has a certain kind of dispassionate passion, a sense that the world has passed her by and that what she could have expected was not forthcoming. A lot of this, and I won't pretend otherwise, is based on an image or a sense that I had of my mother. That particular story, that particular scene to which you refer, and which the cover more or less images, is not one that I knew. It is one that I invented. That's the sort of strategy of a novelist that I was talking about earlier. This is a novel that I think actually one should judge by its cover, because its cover is very beautiful. And when I was shown it by the art folk at Warner Books, for those of you, since this is a phonographic rather than a photographic medium, who aren't staring at your very own copy, the cover illustration has a chair with what's obviously a lady's filmy series of garments draped across it fetchingly. The implicit assumption is that she ain't wearing any. And there is a heavy gilt frame suggesting an oil painting up in the top right. I actually wrote that scene in part to conform with this image. When I was shown it by the publishers, I thought, my God, what a good picture. I'll put that in, and did. The title, too, is one that that stays with me and that I hope will stay with its readership. It comes from a great line by Ezra Pound in the Pisan Cantos. He says, "What thou lovest well remains, the rest is dross." So what remains is, in effect, an image of what I lovest well.
Thus proving once again McLuhan's statement that radio is a hot medium.
Exactly.
Would you like to read some of the book for us?
Sure. I think maybe what I'll do is read a very brief passage from the end of the prologue, which is still in the first person. Because it does sort of attach to this matter that we were talking about the accuracy of memory. What's been going on in the earlier sequence is that I'm in London visiting my uncle, and I've asked him to take me to my childhood home, number 3 Hone Chase, which he dutifully, though dangerously, drives me to because he's a catastrophic driver. Anyway, I wander around it, and I'm full of remembrance about my childhood, and it all comes flooding back more or less the way it did for Marcel Proust when he ate his Madeleine. You know, it's a very moving experience for me, and I so record it. And then we go back home to my uncle's home, and this is just a couple of paragraphs with which that prologue ends. Over tea, I tell my aunt that number 3 Hone Chase is just as I remembered it, the perfect container of childhood. She looks up, adjusting her glasses, and says, "What?" I repeat myself. My absent-minded uncle absently agrees. Aunt Steffi's less vague, however. "Silly, you were born at number 6. So all that Proustian recall was false, a misremembered past. My Madeleine was chocolate cake. My gooseberry bush belonged to a neighbor. Where we lived was 3 doors down. And though it seems funny and just a touch sad that history should prove so subject to revision, I've come to feel grateful for inexactness, the gift, as it were, of invention." And then I launch into the actual invention, if you will, and the novel that follows.
So if we can somehow merge memory with imagination, we sometimes can get a wonderful story from that.
I think that's so. A working title for this book was What You Carry, as opposed to What Remains. I didn't use that for a confluence of reasons, but it was something that my mother often said. She said, you know, they can take away your houses, they can take away your pictures, they can take away your country and your bank account even, but they cannot take what you carry in your head. And so she was helpful and bent on her children getting an education and carrying things in their head, and this is what I've been carrying with me for all this time.
Your final chapter of the book is told from the viewpoint of the mother.
Yes.
And she's waiting for a phone call. And that phone call is from the character that is you. It's a cosmic connection in a way, isn't it?
I did imagine what it must have been like for her when she was alone and increasingly lonely, when, in effect, her closely watched fledglings had flown the nest. And she was wondering, in effect, what else to do with her life. In her case, alas, the rest of her life was brief. She died more than a quarter of a century ago now, and this is the first time I've been able to bring myself to write about that in any sustained fashion. But yes, I tried to evoke her at novel's end, wondering what would come next.
Well, it's very powerfully done, and I felt greatly rewarded when I got to that portion of the book.
Thank you. Let me see if I can find something from that chapter that does describe a little bit this matter of waiting. Yes, I'll just read a paragraph or two from that matter of Julia in 1964 when she's in her late 50s. All the same, about how she has nothing left to do now that her children are gone, and now that she has to imagine what will come next. "All the same, he has a point," her husband. "She needs to find some sort of work. She can order groceries and tell the maid to wash and wax the pantry floor and demonstrate to the laundress how best to iron the shirts, but none of this amounts to proper occupation. There are only so many hours in the day to devote to her roses and orchids. There are only so many cigarettes to smoke and Baumkuchen and brownies and cheese biscuits it's possible to bake. She could have been a translator, but nobody asks her to translate. She could have been an interpreter and would be happy, for example, to interpret for Ralph Bunch. This is a man she respects. This is an honorable enterprise, except she knows nobody at the UN, and in any case they wouldn't invite a middle-aged Westchester housewife to translate 10 hours a week. She's volunteered at Billy's school, her youngest child, but what they want her for is to shelve books or to take attendance at the reception desk. After 2 weeks, when she tried this, Julia couldn't continue, because for someone who once studied with Ernst Cassirer and would have been a doctor of philosophy if Hitler hadn't closed the schools or forbade Jews to be graduated, this is unworthy, an insult, not deliberate perhaps, but insulting nevertheless. Still, she would like to serve. It would help to have somewhere to go. Sometimes, at the Lord and Taylor in Weikergill or in Saks Fifth Avenue, she watches the woman who work behind counters, those who sell perfumes or handbags or scarves, and wonders, since they smile and smile, if she could bring herself to do such work and might find pleasure there. It isn't a question of money, of course, of needing to be paid for it, but needing to be of some use. There would be a certain satisfaction in arranging the perfume and scarves. She can imagine Gucci handbags or Ferragamo shoes, for example, piled in a pyramid on counters so as to catch the eye enticingly and make a customer pause. She herself has often paused to admire such arrangements, and the abundant merchandise in Lord & Taylor is a comfort to behold. But to become a shop girl now would be impossible, unthinkable, and she turns away. Where has it gone, her lightsome youth? Her proud and glad insouciance. And how has she come to this pass?
Nicholas Del Banco reading from his new novel, What Remains. We never know when we're living our lives, when we've hit that exact point as we're crossing into that period of ennui, so to speak, where we're saying, oh, I'm past that. I've passed my peak. We never know when we're right at the peak, do we?
I think we don't. I think it is only clear, if ever, in retrospect, that we've taken a fatal decision or a fateful decision. And in the case of my family, it was, in effect, taken for them. I don't mean by this that they could or would have stayed in Germany throughout the war. Obviously, had they done so, they wouldn't have survived. But the precipitating action, if you will, the reason that caused them to leave, was external. It wasn't something that would have happened, I think, out of an internal imperative, a desire to start a new life or begin anew. As is so often the case in America. Coming to this country, however, was a conscious choice. It was something that my mother sort of pressed my father to do. She said, and I think she was right, that America was a country in which everybody, sooner or later, is an immigrant, and where we would have a real chance of being real citizens. I don't mean by that my family wasn't welcome in England, but there, if you haven't been there for 600 years, and if you speak, as my parents did, of course, with thick foreign accents, you are, in effect, a bloody foreigner. In America, you're part of the crew.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Nicholas Del Banco for his novel, What Remains. And this was not his only appearance in Yellow Springs, because after he made this visit to the Book Nook, he was noticed by the Antioch Writers' Workshop, and a few years later came back to the village of Yellow Springs to be the keynote speaker for the Antioch Writers' Workshop. We'll continue with this interview with our final segment and a little Book Nook bonus coming up right after this break.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. It's the Best of the Book Nook, and we went back to the year 2001 for my one and only interview with the novelist Nicholas Del Banco. We talked about his book, What Remains. And don't go away, because we have a little extra time at the end of this segment, and I've got a little surprise for you, part of an interview I did some years ago with a very well-known comedian. Let's listen now to Nicholas Del Banco closing out our interview from 2001.
Nicholas, was it a sense of relief for you when this book finally got published?
You know, I was quite nervous about it in terms of my family's reaction, in the sense that I was anxious not to tread on other people's versions of the same story or what may have been raw memories. But I've been, I think, almost wholly happy about that. I did give a reading from it in New York a little bit ago, and my father came, and when somebody asked him more or less just precisely that question, he said, "You forgot the Marshall Plan," as a way of reminding me that I should have put that in as an explanation of why we came. And I thought, well, if that was his objection, then I was home free. I must also say, wholly happily, that the degree of public response in, you know, New York and Washington and the West Coast and what have you has been almost wholly unforeseen by me. I mean by this that I wrote this book as a private gesture, as a way of tipping my hat to the dear dead and to the one or two who survive. And I was simply grateful to my publisher, Warner Books, that that they sort of allowed me to bring it into print. It never frankly occurred to me that it would strike so many chords and so and attain so widespread an audience. I don't mean by this to say that it's, you know, a national bestseller or anything, but wherever I've gone, people have come out of the woodwork, and there have been some reviews just now in Europe, and I've been hearing from people in Vienna and London equally. In other words, what I thought of this as a wholly private text has struck a surprisingly public chord. And so in that sense, it's a surprise as well as a relief.
We're seeing so many books coming out in the last year or two that focus on the period of World War II, on the 40s. Mm. That generation
right.
is fading into memory.
Right.
Your book clearly has deep roots in that era, in that period. And I'm just fascinated with that period. My dad fought in World War II, and he's gone now. And we have so many people out there who have these memories, these vivid memories of the past that are disappearing one by one. I had Amanda Smith on the program last week. She's a granddaughter of Joseph Kennedy, and
yes.
just wrote this or edited this book of his letters.
Absolutely.
It was intriguing to me to read these letters, and he has a lot of private diary things mm-hmm. in there where he comes off as being anti-Semitic and all
yes.
these other things, and she didn't want to hide that. She wanted people to know what he was really like. And being a member of the family, I was impressed.
Yeah, it's not I think the more you lift that rock, the more you see what's crawling underneath it. I think it was an act of brave attestation on her part, because there had been an awful lot of sort of public relations about the Kennedy family, and particularly about the grand old man and his great brood. He had a lot to answer for, and I'm glad that she sets the record, if not straight, at least out in the open air that way. To answer the first part of your question or the first part of your thought, I in fact wrote this book almost twice as long in an early draft, in which I had a whole other series of chapters about the little Benjamin grown sufficiently up to go back to England in the 1960s and live there again under the assumption he might indeed call it home. I mean this literally. The book was almost twice as long at a certain stage. And I finally just cut all that stuff out because it seemed entirely beside the point, which was to try and focus on the 40s, then to flash forward only briefly, as I've done. And I don't say this because I'm mulling a sequel. You know, you loved him in Hampstead, watch him in Manhattan. But because in the end, what remained for me was precisely what you're talking about, that generation, that world, that stressful time.
So the only trace that remains of that period in the book is at the end when Benjamin calls.
Exactly so. I had 100-odd pages of what he was doing in London before that phone call.
Now, was he working with Gustav?
What a close reader you are. The answer is yes. He went to the art gallery and deluded himself that he was an Englishman and was disabused of that notion, and so had elected America, in effect, and was going to come back. But all of that belongs more to my personal history than it does to the effect of the novel, I think. So that's gone.
Well, I must say I derived a great deal of vicarious enjoyment from hearing about them starting this enterprise, this gallery, so to speak, after World War II, and hearing about the goodies that they were finding was rather enticing.
Yes, back in those decades, what we now construe to be, you know, rare masterworks were, if not dime a dozen or penny a pound, they were at least plentiful. And particularly right after the war, when there any number of families and houses were sort of being reconstituted, there was an extraordinary availability of what we now construe to be priceless artifacts available for next to nothing.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, and it's been a pleasure meeting you in person.
Thank you, Vic. It's been a real pleasure to be here, and you asked exactly the kinds of questions that caused me to run on, if not off at the mouth. Thanks again.
Well, we're both doing our job then.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Nicholas Del Bunco for his novel, What Remains. And he was so incredibly erudite and articulate, and we had a wonderful conversation that day. And I'll never forget it because I had such a moment of embarrassment when the interview was over because I walked him out into the studio, and we just had such a rapport. As you probably could tell from listening to that interview, he was so tickled that I had read his book, and I was so familiar with it. And for some reason, as he was walking out with his escort and getting ready to drive off, I said, "It's really been nice meeting you, Anthony." And, of course, his name is Nicholas, and I was mortified because I realized my mistake. I don't know why. Maybe he just looked like an Anthony to me. I don't know why I called him Anthony, but he was crestfallen. His face just dropped, and I've regretted that to this day. I remember it so well. Okay, I've got a little treat for you. Back in 2001, the same year I recorded that interview with Nicholas Del Bunco, the Smothers brothers, Tom and Dick Smothers, were coming to the Fraze Pavilion to make an appearance with the Dayton Philharmonic Orchestra. And I did a brief interview with Tom Smothers. He was at his vineyard in California. Let's listen now to a little excerpt from my conversation with Tommy Smothers.
I think it was Newhart.
Cosby
and the Smothers Brothers. Von Meter was selling some albums back then, too.
The parody of the Kennedys?
Right.
Yeah. The First Family, wasn't it?
The First Family, yes. Yeah. We're old enough to remember all this stuff.
Yeah, I admit it. I've been following you guys for a while. Now, how do you guys keep it fresh? You've been doing this for a long time. How do you keep that spark going?
Well, basically, what we do is if we start to bore ourselves, that's the time to change. So when we keep the comedy fresh by just keeping it not verbatim. It's always improvisational, so I can throw something in anytime I want. If things get a little flat and we see we're starting to anticipate and not be spontaneous, then we'll just take off on another direction, and pretty soon it's just people feel it. So it's all been improv from the beginning, and we got to be careful that once we get a nice piece, it doesn't become too set. So we just kind of change it around a little bit. The music's a little more difficult for us to, we can't put out album after album of different songs, but we constantly change the comedy material. Because if it's fresh for us, it's fresh for the audience, invariably. Dick is a great straight man.
He sure is.
In fact, we're the last. Are we the last comedy team? There used to be comedy teams all over the place. There used to be a standard of the comedy mindset of America. There was always a fat one, a short one, a smart one, a dumb one. And now everybody's a stand-up, and comedy teams are difficult. It's like a marriage. You're in each other's face. It's like a difficult dance, and sometimes one of us doesn't feel right, or the other one's a little edgy, or we've had a little squabble. It kind of shows up in it.
Now, you guys live pretty far apart. You live out in California. Doesn't Dick live in Florida now?
He lives in Florida now, but it doesn't matter. When we start off, we could both be in California, same expense, same amount of time flying, except we don't fly together. And it's funny, because if you're not on television or you don't have national exposure, there's a tendency to think maybe you've retired or something. But we have been around now. This is our 43rd year. So sometimes people think, hey, you guys still working? I said, no, we passed away in 1969. we're just walking around as ghosts now.
Well, speaking of television, Tom, I loved your TV program. And it's hard to believe that when we see television now, they used to think that what you were doing was controversial.
Well, you know, there's two viewpoints on that, and I've had many people say, don't you wish you were on television now? You can say anything you want. Well, it's not exactly true. Smothers Brothers were the last show in prime time to have political satire or to satirize national policy or whatever. Since that time, political satire, particularly, is done at 11:30 at night with Dennis Miller or Bill Maher,
uh-huh.
And it's all at 11:30, 12 o'clock spectrum where the viewing is way, way down. So it's not the use of four-letter words and sexual references that give this illusion of this freedom of speech thing. And I have a viewpoint on it. You know, it's like the left wing or the liberal side that really supports the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. I think sometimes they let it go too far.
Uh-huh.
And the conservatives are the big supporters of the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and that goes too far. So the extremes of embracing something that they encourage it, but there's not much going on in as far as political satire and television today. And Dickie and I, you know, we did our last show was in New York. We did 2 weeks at a small cabaret, and one of the reviewers said, "Oh, the show's funny and everything like that." But come on, you guys, I didn't hear any political satire. I didn't hear any scathing remarks. I go, hold on here. We protested the war and it was 30-something years ago, the war in Vietnam. Am I required now for the Smothers Brothers the rest of their lives to be political satirists? The war is over.
Yeah.
A lot of bad stuff going on still, but it's harder to see who the white hats, the good guys and the bad guys are. Everybody pretends to be a good guy, and it's kind of hard to get your targets as clearly as it was back in the 60s.
Well, we think you're good guys, Tom.
Well, thank you, Vic. It's Tommy and Dickie, by the way. Sometimes they forget our names.
Tommy and Dickie Smothers, the Smothers Brothers, and good luck with that noble rot.
Okay. That's botrytis. Yeah, that's a nice late harvest botrytis. Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye. That was Tom Smothers. And that was our Book Nook bonus segment there. He didn't have a book, but he was a very funny man. In fact, he's still a funny man, I'm sure. Tommy Smothers. He and his brother Dickie, as he pointed out, Tommy and Dickie Smothers, were coming to Kettering 19 years ago to appear with the Dayton Philharmonic Orchestra. I talked to him for about 10 minutes that day at his vineyard in Sonoma County, California. And what a nice guy. What a fun guy. And I have vivid memories of their cutting-edge TV program from the late 1960s. They were very outspoken about politics. They were very much against the Vietnam War, and they were kind of driven off the network. I think they were on CBS, if I recall. Anyway, that was Tommy Smothers. Don't miss the Book Nook tomorrow, 10:30 Sunday morning, when I'll be talking to David Pepper about his new novel, The Voter File,
And by the way, he's the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. That's coming up in the Book Nook tomorrow morning at 10:30. Thanks again for listening.